Welcome to New Thinking for a New World, a Tilburg Foundation podcast. I am Alan Stoga, your host. Each week, I bring you conversations with people who think differently about the great issues that are shaping our world. Geopolitics, disruptive tech, mass migration, the changing climate, culture wars, all of it is grist for our mill. I hope you enjoy listening. I also hope you will let me know what you think and that you join the conversation at tilburgfoundation.org. And now for today's episode of New Thinking for a New World. In a year of global elections, something like half of the world goes to the polls this year. Immigration and immigrants are getting lots of attention. Most of it's negative. Policies are being tightened. The media is full of stories demonizing immigrants. Political candidates, especially populists, are demanding borders be shut. And even their more moderate opponents are scurrying around looking for policies that at least make them look tough. Once again, there's a growing sense that migrants are a problem. That's not particularly surprising in a world of increasing conflict, weak economic growth, and populist bombast. Who to blame? Blame the migrants. It's easy. Or perhaps focus on facts and try to drain some of the emotion out of the conversation. To do exactly that, my guest today is Andrew Seeley, president of the Migration Policy Institute, which is based in Washington. He and his colleagues research and advocate for the kinds of well-thought-out, pragmatic immigration policies needed to build a secure and prosperous future around the world. Welcome, Andrew.
Thank you for having me, Alan. Great to be here.
Let's start with the facts. Media headlines and political speeches suggest that global migration is again not only on the rise, but is overwhelming us. What's going on?
You know, it's surprising that the number of migrants around the world, the number of people who live in a country that's not where they were born, right, which is how we, in a broad sense, define this, is going up slowly. It's actually not, it is growing up every year by a little bit, but it's about 3.6% of the world's population last we checked, which means that, you know, 96.4% of the population of the world lives in the country that they were born in. It is going up. You know, but it is going up gradually. What you are seeing, though, is that it's become more unpredictable. You know, migrants, particularly those that are willing to pursue an irregular journey, that are willing to cross borders without legal paperwork to do so, have a little more in terms of options. They can go further than they used to, and they can suddenly take new journeys that no one had predicted. And so I think that generates a sense that migration is out of control. But the numbers are actually not going up that much. Now, the U.S. is an exception here. The U.S. is getting more people in the past 2 or 3 years. And really, if you look sort of, it was starting pre-COVID, went down, and then came back after COVID. So since about 2018, we have seen a larger number of people coming through the southwest border than we did in the past. So the U.S. is an outlier in that. But in all places, it looks like it's gone up more than it has just because it's more unpredictable.
Well, the U.S. is a huge outlier. December alone was something like 250,000 people on the southern border. And as you said, the last couple of years have spiked. But also in Europe, Europe reports more than 1 million asylum applications last year, not counting the Ukrainians, which are another 3-4, pick a number. 10 countries in Europe, including a couple of the big ones, France and the UK, Spain, have reported records. Again, these are relatively small numbers, but it's depends on your perspective. So there's headlines. I saw just today that Sudan has sent something like 450,000 people because of the war into neighboring countries just in the last few months. So you get a sense that, yes, a lot of people are on the move. It may not be the kind of hysterical headlines, except perhaps in the U.S. Is this sort of steady state?
You know, it's hard to know. I mean, this has always throughout history gone up and down. I do think what has changed, though, is both communication technology and transportation. There are more flights to more places. There is more possible with the kind of communication, social media technology that we have today to actually plan a journey across multiple countries that no one ever could have thought of at another time. And I wouldn't discount one other thing here, which will sound counterintuitive, but it may be also because the world's a little less poor than it once was. And look, there's an enormous amount of poverty around the world. But the reality is there was a time when most people could not actually think about making an international journey. Or if they could, it was to a journey to the country next door. you know, at most, some country that was maybe slightly better off than where they were. They're still poor, but they have a little bit of savings. They can actually think about, you know, whether they invest in a smuggler and they invest in something, you know, a small business or, you know, a little more education. And when they look at the options, they say, look, I don't think staying here is as good as getting a smuggler and going somewhere else. And so, you know, actually being slightly less poor may be another incentive for people to move, at least in the short term.
Terribly important point. It's not that migration is a luxury good, that's an economist talking, but rather that you probably need some resources to move, except in the most extreme cases of violence and disorder.
Exactly. Well, in extreme cases, people will move however it is, and they will often move sort of massively together, right? I mean, because they don't have a choice. But otherwise, people are making strategic choices about this. And the reality is people are still poor, but they have a little more. They were poor and immobile before, and now they're poor and mobile in many cases. And, you know, I think that adds to this as well.
The other piece of today's reality, and this is something that you in particular, but MPI more generally have pointed out, is that it's not just North America and Europe that are the destinations. Now, that was always the case. African migration is mostly internal to Africa. Our perception in the North, the global North, we aren't supposed to talk about it that way, is that everybody wants to get in, and they may. But you're looking at countries like Mexico, like Colombia, like Turkey, like Jordan, like South Africa, that in fact have become destination countries. Is that because they can't get into the U.S. and Europe?
It's because they can't get into the U.S. and Europe, but it's also because those are decent destinations for many people, right? I mean, there was a time when, you know, the other thing that's going on here is that the world is getting older, right? Lots of countries are getting older. The exceptions are, you know, most of the countries in Africa, a couple countries in Southeast Asia, a handful of countries in the Western Hemisphere, Haiti, you know, Guatemala, Honduras, Nicaragua. Maybe forgetting one or two there. But, you know, most countries in the world are getting older. And so, you know, some of these countries are both better off economically. They become middle income countries and sometimes upper middle income countries. And they have older populations with workforce needs. And so a country like Mexico suddenly becomes attractive, not for everyone. You know, most Guatemalans would probably rather get to the United States. But if you're worried about getting to the United States, if you think it's a dangerous journey and you're traveling with your child, or you know someone's already living in Mexico, Mexico suddenly becomes an interesting option, particularly in the north of the country, where there's in the more industrial parts of the country, where there are real labor market needs and where they're looking for ready and willing workers. And the same thing holds in Brazil, the same thing in Chile. I mean, Chile is getting a lot of migration these days because it's an attractive destination for people from other parts of Latin America, especially Venezuela. South Africa, as you mentioned, Turkey, certainly. And then, of course, there's the, you know, the two other big drivers, the East Asia, which has been so far less open to large scale migration and physically a little bit removed, but where there are huge labor force needs, right, and aging populations. And then you have the Gulf, and the Gulf has exploded over the past 20 or 30 years and has been really willing to recruit guest labor. But there are now millions and millions of people from Asia and Africa moving, and a little bit the rest of the Middle East, but mostly Asia and Africa, moving to the Gulf and working there for periods of time and making money. And we can question the working conditions. They're not always great, but for many people, it's a step up from what they were doing before.
The conclusion, I guess, of chapter one here is that more migration, not as crazy as the headlines might suggest it, but it's going to continue, probably continue to grow for good reasons as well as bad reasons.
That's right. I think that's exactly where we are. And look, the other aging societies, of course, are United States, Canada, Australia, European countries, right? I mean, they, you know, we are going to need workers one way or another. We're going to need people paying into our pension systems. We're likely to need to figure out whether we want these people to come legally or we accept the fact that they're coming on unauthorized journeys, and but they're going to come one way or another.
So let's talk about some of the policies that countries are implementing. I know that you've done, you, MPI, have done some work recently with Bertelsmann in trying to set up a real-time monitoring of policy changes, in part because policies are changing pretty rapidly. Just recently looking at Europe, you've got Italy's deal with Albania, the UK's with Rwanda. You've got the French on again, off again. Did they really pass it or not pass new policy? You've got the EU new migration policy as a whole. Several capitals talking about deals with whether it's Egypt or Tunisia, and and even the notion of establishing asylum centers outside of Europe. We can keep them at home, we'll process them there, which of course is something that the United States has also tried. Are there common themes in all of that in terms of where policy is headed, good, bad, or ugly?
So I think there's a little bit of everything, right? I think there's some instinct in many countries to say, let's just stop people from coming. And look, you can deter people. There's no question that enforcement can deter people. And if you make it uncomfortable for them to live where they've arrived, you might bring the numbers down a bit. But it has some downsides, right? I mean, if you make it uncomfortable for people who don't have documents but have been there for a long time, you also make it uncomfortable for their kids who may be citizens of the country. You know, you may be driving out your workforce. And so there's some real, you know, there's real questions you get into. But certainly that's one trend, right? The other trend is, you know, can we begin to be a little bit more clinical about our asylum systems? Asylum systems have become overburdened almost everywhere in the world, at least in developed countries. And, you know, can we make them a little bit more intentional, a little bit quicker, more fair at the same time, better able to give people protection if they in fact need it, but also able to sort out people who don't need protection and return them so that it doesn't create an unnecessary attraction? And can you combine that by thinking about, you know, putting center protection closer where people live? I mean, if you were actually had ways that people could apply for protection, say, in Central America, in South America, in Africa, you know, then people would be less likely maybe to head north and try and get on a boat across the Mediterranean or get across the U.S. border. So, I think those are some of the options that are out there. And then there's the whole question of legal pathways. I mean, this whole question of if we know that some countries will need workers and others will have a supply, can we be intentional about building the visa pathways that allow people to come permanently or come temporarily? You know, not everyone, frankly, wants to move to the United States and live in the United States, right? Or move to Germany and live in Germany. A lot of people would like to go make money and go back home again. So can we start thinking about what are those jobs that require workers to actually go permanently, where we will need to have people come and live? And what are the jobs where it makes sense for people to come temporarily? And by the way, are there jobs also that can be, you know, can be hybrid jobs or can be remote jobs, which is, you know, maybe people don't have to move. Maybe actually people can stay where they are.
So let me drill down a little bit. You've got a couple of things going on. You've got countries, destination countries like Italy, like France, the UK, others, looking for two things, either for places outside, in this case, Europe, where they can send people who don't meet local requirements and or that will stop people from coming, process them before they actually get on a boat or a plane or walk. That kind of outsourcing, to use a word that is probably not humane enough, seems to be it. One of the pathways that some destination countries want to go. Can that be done, in your judgment, in a way that makes sense, that is coherent with law, never mind morality?
There's some ways of maybe doing it. Let me start with the fact, I mean, the challenge of asylum systems is that once anyone is on your territory, is for any country that's a signatory of the Refugee Convention, they're obligated to see if they qualify for refugee status, right? And you know, you can get a large number of people showing up and then qualifying, and most systems don't seem to be able to work efficiently enough to actually process people in real time. I think one of the opportunities there is to, and this is what the U.S. Senate was trying to do recently, is try and speed up the process by and have a screening process that is a little more strict up front and that happens quickly and is resourced well enough that then people, you know, don't stay in the country for long periods of time waiting for a hearing, the decisions made quickly. But there's problems with that too. I mean, one is resourcing it sufficiently. Another is, can you return people if they don't qualify, right? So it's fine to make a decision, but if they're coming from a country where you don't have a repatriation agreement, you can't put them on an airplane back, you know, it may not make a difference. So countries are then looking at other options. The U.S. has gone out and created these things called safe mobility offices, which is the more humane approach to this is trying to make refugee decisions earlier So deciding in Colombia and Ecuador and Costa Rica and Guatemala whether someone has a refugee claim, saying you don't have to go all the way to the U.S. border. We'll put you on an airplane and send you there if you have a refugee claim. If not, you'll know that you don't qualify. You're seeing other countries, the extreme other side is probably the U.K., saying they'll send them to Rwanda to run them through the asylum process there. And if not, they stay. And then you're seeing countries in the middle. I would say sort of Italy and Albania is intriguing.
It really, the devil's in the details. I mean, what the Italians have said so far is that there would be an agreement with Albania through which any asylum seeker would be sent to Albania, but would go through the Italian asylum system, and that the Italian government would be responsible both for the outcome, well, for positive outcomes. They would have to go to Italy to receive refugee status if they get a positive outcome. And Italy is responsible for sending them back to where they came from if they do not. And so it's basically a secure country where they can go through the process offsite. But again, you know, a lot depends on the specifics of that. But that is a possible way forward that might actually pass the muster of the Refugee Convention and UNHCR. But it comes down to the specifics.
Let's segue for a moment, because that is, I think, the second time you've mentioned the 1951 Refugee Convention, which everybody in your world knows and everybody in the rest of the world has never heard of. But it is important because it's foundational, no?
Countries agreed after World War II that they would take anyone who was being persecuted in their home country for a variety of grounds and would give them asylum, would give them protection in another country, right? In the country they had reached. And it was revolutionary. They had tried to do things like this before, but it was really revolutionary because they were thinking at the time of people who had been displaced because of the Holocaust, because of World War II, who were being displaced because of the Cold War, dissidents in Eastern Europe and Soviet Union. But it has become, in a world that's in upheaval, it has become, you know, increasingly a challenge to figure out how you give protection to everyone that crosses borders, who has protection needs, who's being persecuted. Who does it, where you do it, and how you make distinctions between people who fit the convention definition of a refugee and those that don't. And so this is becoming one of the big issues in immigration systems. And some people would just love to throw the whole thing out, but it really has been foundational in making sure that people who are not protected in their country, who cannot stay in their country, do get protection elsewhere, can go live somewhere else. It's part of what makes us, you know, an interconnected, you know, planet where we look out for each other and we make sure that people can get to safety. But how you implement it is complicated in a world where people are more mobile.
And to be precise, it is a convention that has been written into law in most countries in the world.
That's right. Yeah, pretty much all modern democracies subscribe to it. There are a few that have some limitations, but most of them, you know, and all the countries in the Americas and in Europe are subscribers to it, and most countries around the world.
Do you know leaders who, young or old, regardless of where they live or what they do, who are changing the world? Leaders who are not content with what is and are working hard for what could be? If so, please nominate them for the Telberg SNF Eliason Global Leadership Prize at telbergprize.org. The nomination period will open on March 15th. Let's go back to two other examples, both of which I would argue are in their own ways positive. Oh, you put air quotes on that word, because I'm going to ask about Ukraine and Venezuela. In both cases, horrific problems in the country, both countries, produced massive diaspora, millions and millions of people in a very short period of time. And in both cases, in Europe, Poland and other countries pretty much welcomed the Ukrainians, gave them the right to work, tried to work with that diaspora for all sorts of political reasons. Similarly, in Latin America, much to certainly my surprise, the Venezuelans were welcomed in Colombia and other countries. Again, right to work, efforts to make their exile comfortable. I suspect in both cases, the hope is that this isn't a permanent transfer of population. So there is that asterisk next to the example. But how do you think about those two cases? And is there anything we can learn from them that might apply elsewhere?
I think so. I mean, we've seen the last two big crises have been dealt with in creative ways. They did not invoke the Refugee Convention. There's a handful of Venezuelans and Ukrainians that have applied for asylum and gotten refugee protection. For the most part, most countries didn't do that. They found a different way of bringing people in on temporary visas and or temporary statuses. In most countries, in the case of Europe, it was, you know, relatively easy once they decided it because they have something called the Temporary Protection Directive. All the countries in the European Union agreed to it, and Ukrainians already had visa-free travel to Europe, so they could get to Europe. And what the directive says is that in any of the countries of the European Union, they can stay as long as the directive allows, which is up to 3 years. They keep approving new years, but they have to figure out what to do after 3 years, actually. And they're entitled to the same rights as people in those countries, which means they can work, they can go to school, they can do, they have access to healthcare. And it's been a very easy transition. When you talk to people, you know, it's been tough on some of the frontline countries that get large numbers like Poland. But overall, the countries where a lot of people are going, Germany and Spain, for example, have been able to deal with this because it's a very managed process. And you see the same thing in Latin America. I mean, you know, these are countries that don't have the same sort of infrastructure and they didn't all make the same decision. Each country made a different decision. You know, Colombia's got 2.8 million Venezuelans. Colombia, that was a country that had almost no immigrants, suddenly has 2.8 million, 6% of their population is born in Venezuela. 1.5 million in Peru, 500,000 in Ecuador, and 500,000 in Chile, 500,000 in Brazil. I mean, you can go down the line. Most of these countries have made some sort of allowance that has allowed people to stay legally, to go into the labor market, to access education and some part of the healthcare system. And you know what? They're being rewarded for it because what you find out is people come in, they work, and they contribute to, you know, the economy of the countries. And because they've given them legal status, it's a lot less difficult than if you were dealing with people who were seen as arriving illegally.
And the process, the underlying foundation is different for both Ukraine and Venezuela. There's an empathy for what these people are going through in their own countries. There is a cultural affinity. Difference between the Polish culture and the Ukrainian culture is minimal. You have religious values, et cetera, et cetera. Those might be special cases, but they're positive cases. I mean, they're cases that perhaps could indeed be built on.
I think that's right. I don't think we can generalize and say everywhere in the world will do the same thing. You know, it helps that they're educated populations. I mean, Venezuela was the most educated and the wealthiest country for a long time in South America. And generally speaking, Venezuelans are on average just a little bit more educated than the countries where they've arrived, in some cases quite a bit more educated. Ukrainians are fairly well educated, not a wealthy country, but the high education level. And what you say, cultural affinity, and then foreign policy, right? There was the whole question that my enemy is my friend, right? These are people who are fleeing from tyrannical regimes. You know, in the case of Europe, it's, you know, everyone's solidarity with Ukraine over the Russian invasion, not wanting to be next themselves. In the case of Latin America, looking at Maduro and the Venezuelan regime as a regime that is an outlier and wanting to show their solidarity. So foreign policy played into this too. And I don't think we should discount this. By the way, the refugee system worked really well during the Cold War, in part because people took in those that were fleeing from their enemies, right? And so these foreign policy considerations mattered. Why did the U.S. take in so many Vietnamese? Because the U.S. had supported the South Vietnamese government.
On the other hand, you've got the Middle East. You've got some of the African wars. You have Central America. You have issues in Asia like the Rohingya that are almost uniformly treated badly, that are almost uniformly not welcome, and hence swell the illegal line because they can't get anywhere through the legal line. But how ought we think about that handful of places that don't have the kind of empathy or sympathy that certainly help a Ukraine or a Venezuela?
It's a lot tougher. I mean, the reality is they're not going as far. They're going to countries that have a lot of extreme poverty. They're going to countries with weak institutions to be able to maintain them. And what tends to end up happening is the international community steps in to maintain them, right? And you have Somalis in Kenya, for example, who have been there for, you know, decades and are basically maintained by the international community, but don't have the ability to move into a dignified life where they're in the labor market and starting over again, which has been the magic, I think, for Venezuelans and Ukrainians. Again, with lots of problems, it's never, you know, it's never easy to start over. It's never easy to be driven out of your homeland by any means. But they've been able to start, at least the countries have given them the ability to start their lives over. You know, that's not true if you're in a refugee camp, if you're a Sudanese who's in a refugee camp in a nearby country or Somali. I mean, that these are, you know, or in the case of Syrians who are in protracted situations in Jordan and Lebanon. So I think these are that's a tough question. It is, a question that we should be learning from the Ukraine and Venezuelan experiences, that it may actually be better for some of the host countries if these people can move into the labor market, can start over and have jobs, can not be in refugee camps, but actually can begin to live lives of dignity. Uganda has tried to do this, actually, with a lot of the African refugees that have arrived. And it's so far paying off in the case of Uganda. Ethiopia started as well. But, you know, we have to get beyond the notion that the international community is going to just do care and feeding. That doesn't preserve people's dignity and doesn't help them start over. And then there's always the question of, can people go back? But, you know, what we know from past experience is, you know, once someone has been out of their country in a protracted situation for 3 or 4 years, you know, rarely do things get patched up enough in the country they were expelled from for them to be able to go back. And people start their lives over in some cases as well.
We've talked about the numbers. We've talked about policy a little bit. Let's talk about politics. And there I'm going to start uncomfortably with geopolitics. We have talked about Europe, good, bad. We've talked about America. We'll talk about that more, good, bad. The other superpower is China. And China tends never to come up in these conversations, partially because nobody wants to go to China so that they don't have to cope with a refugee problem. But are they playing, as they become more important globally, a serious power in the multilateral framework, do they play any kind of role on this issue? And if so, what?
You know, China has been somewhat ambivalent on these issues. They have at times supported the international refugee regime, but they have a less clear place on this than other countries. And for the most part, they're not in danger of people headed towards China. But China is also at a turning point, right? China has not had to think about immigration because it had such a large internal population. And migration from rural areas to mid-sized cities and mid-sized cities to big cities has done for China what, you know, as it's industrialized sort of from the east to west, it has done for China what immigration from other lands has done for other countries. But China's reaching a point where there's not that much more internal migration to happen. And I think there will be a question in the coming years of, does China open up in some way to immigration? And they have had some immigration from nearby countries, a little bit from Africa. They've tried to attract top-level talent, primarily from the Chinese diaspora abroad. But I do think there's a pending conversation. You start to hear this from some Chinese thinkers about whether China needs an immigration policy. And then the question becomes, does it become attractive also for refugees also? And at which point, you know, I think you may see much more engagement on these issues. But, you know, there's a little bit of time lag here, but I think it's going to start to catch up. You've seen other countries like Japan, which has very limited immigration, has started to have more immigration for work reasons in the past few years. But Japan has always been a big player on international refugee issues, despite not being a major immigration country. But that is an exception.
Well, in fairness to the Japanese, that was effectively part of the deal. You are not going to take migrants. You said you want a homogeneous society. But, and I don't mean this just in a crude financial sense, you're willing to support the system. You're willing to pay for the system. They send, as you know, people to run these systems.
That's right.
So they've been engaged not just with dollars, but also with talent.
A lot of talent. I mean, they've invested heavily in this. But Japan is also, of course, a country now that is suddenly in the place of needing a workforce, right? It's an aging population. Japan and Korea and Italy, right, are among the countries with the oldest populations in the world. And you started to see in both Japan and Korea attempts to bring in workers primarily through temporary programs and training programs. But now they're beginning to have the debate of, do they let people settle permanently? Do they actually have to have immigration to meet not only the workforce needs, but also who's paying into pension plans and public services for the long term? And so they may suddenly, and they've had, you know, Japan has been willing to discuss taking small numbers of refugees as part of that as well. We'll see if that changes over time.
You've just put your finger on one of the great ironies of this entire conversation, which is that the industrial world is aging at an accelerating pace. We don't yet have the technology to have technology replace those workers. It will happen in time, probably, but there is a severe timing problem. Yet it is exactly the politicians and especially the populists, more on the right, but also on the left, who are screeching the loudest about not wanting to take more migrants, that this is a problem, not a solution, that we need to put barriers. That's obviously true in the United States in terms of the U.S. debate, but it's true in Italy, it's true in the Netherlands, it's true in the U.K., it's true all over the place. How do you think about that? Is it just politicians being stupid, which is always one possibility? Is it politicians being responsive to voters? That's what people want, good, bad, or ugly. And does it risk a disaster?
I think it definitely risks a disaster. But I think there's three things going on here, right? I mean, there is one, I think there is a set of people in most of the countries where immigrants are arriving, most developed countries, who are really worried about cultural change, right? They're worried about the way immigrants, in fact, change the society they move into. And the U.S., we have this, but the U.S. actually is a society that has long had changed through immigration. It's much tougher in a country like Japan or Korea or China someday, where this will be a new experience, right? It already is a new experience with limited immigration, and it's going to get bigger. But it's a big issue in, you know, the United States and France and Germany. I mean, take your pick, Denmark, Sweden. You know, these are cultural change. People who arrive change the culture. That I would say that's a good thing in most cases. But we can also understand how that also challenges people's notion of what it means to belong to those countries. There's a second thing going on where some jobs are becoming precarious, primarily working class jobs in some societies. And I think people are not sure whether immigrants or robots or trade is the culprit. And immigrants are the easier to blame. And so I think there's some precariousness in the workforce that goes into this as well. And that's actually understandable. And it's worth a real conversation around this. Most of the evidence tells us that immigrants are complements to existing workers. They actually expand the economy at the same time that they take jobs, and that tends to end up benefiting the society overall. But it is worth having those conversations and looking at the impacts. And the third thing that's going on, you know, those are two things that I think mitigate against immigration in general, where some parts of populations are really worried about immigration in general. That's not the majority, but it's some part of the population, at least not in the United States, perhaps in some other countries. But the other is this lack of control. And I think that is where you get the middle ground begins to move a little bit. And, you know, there's a lot of people, there's a great Wall Street Journal poll recently that showed that most Americans are really worried about the border. And this tracks with what Gallup tells us as well. They're very worried about the border, but they're actually quite in favor of immigration. You know, and Americans actually get the nuance here. They get the fact that we need workers. They know immigrants. They may be immigrants themselves. You know, many, many Americans, you know, are either immigrants, children of immigrants, spouses of immigrants, right? I mean, this is part of our lives. So Americans aren't mostly anti-immigrant. They actually know that immigration is part of the United States. And if anything, people have gotten more positive on immigration over time. What they're concerned about is there's not an order for how people come in and that they have seen the system break down and they don't want decisions on immigration made without knowing that there's credibility in the system. And I think that's what moves the middle ground, at least in the United States.
I think that's a terrific point. I will complement it with an anecdote. I remember during the big German migration when Merkel threw open the border and a million people show up. I was talking to a German friend of mine who I would put on the far center right, not the far right, but the far center right. And she was complaining about the policy. And I thought it was going to be a racist rant. Turned out what she was incredibly upset about was the disorder. She actually said, we're Germans. We know how to do this kind of stuff. We should just do it right. And so it makes your point that part of the failure of the system, which is to say the failure of the politicians and the institutions, is that we have the messes that I can watch on my TV, whether it be in Italy or in the United States or in Britain. Solving that problem, getting competence back into government, I think it's a general problem, but it's a very specific issue with regard to this space, I think.
Yeah, you know, I've been fascinated watching Giorgia Meloni, the Prime Minister of Italy, because she has gone from being a, you know, she ran on a very anti-immigration platform when she in the parliamentary elections, but she has now come around on the fact that Italy needs workers, that Italy needs people to come in through labor immigration routes. And so she has a much more nuanced view, right, which is she's trying to stop unauthorized migration, but she's trying to figure out how they encourage work migration. Now, I'm not sure they've really hit the sweet spot on how to do this, but I think it tells you that the contradictions that are in the system. You know, in the United States, I think there's, you know, Republicans have often in recent years erred on the side of thinking that they can just keep people out. I don't think that's the way the Republican Party used to be, by the way. I mean, I think that's this is a shift away from the Bush presidency, the two Bush presidencies, to a different Republican Party. But the tendency has been we can keep people out. But Democrats go the other way, and Democrats err on the side of not understanding that they need some control too, and that people really want to know they're okay with folks coming in. They want to know how they got there and that they came through an orderly process. And I think either of those positions is an outlier. You know, most Americans are somewhere in the middle. And I think most people in most countries are somewhere in the middle. The middle may be slightly different places in different countries. There may be different comfort levels with immigration overall. But in most industrial countries, we know we need workers. We know we need people to pay into the system. By the way, not all of them have to stay permanently. You know, I think there's also a fallacy sometimes thinking that all immigration is permanent. A lot of people would like to come and work and go home after a period of time. But we are going to need immigrants. The question is, what system are we going to use that makes it possible? And then we got to police the system. I mean, you do have to enforce the system.
So you're in the business of trying to think about, define, and advocate smart policies that address all of the issues we've talked about for the last half hour.
Yeah, I think that, yeah.
What most worries you?
What worries me, I think, is us, is that this becomes a symbolic dividing line. It ultimately becomes about other things. You know, I joke to my colleagues sometimes that I wake up in the morning and see immigration issues all over the media. And I think, wow, you know, we're really in the center of everything and this is great. And then by noon, I realize that most of this is symbolic politics and has nothing really to do with immigration policy, right? This is shorthand for what we think about diversity or what we think about sovereignty or, you know, there's a lot of things, you know, we want to build a wall on the border with Mexico is really not about Mexico and not about immigration, but is about bigger things, about a threatening world, you know, or we don't want to send anyone home because that would be a violation of our commitment to build a diverse society. I mean, you know, these become shorthand for these other debates we're having. And my fear is that our real need to come up with sensible policy on immigration that helps our economies, that allows families to stay together, that, you know, allows us to have good universities that attract people, that allow people to, in poor countries, to be able to have an opportunity to earn more money and send it back and pull themselves out of poverty. All these good things that we could do with migration come crashing down because it becomes a shorthand for all these other fears that we have. And you know, we spend a lot of our time trying to get back to what the real issues are and how you actually make some sensible decisions and try and crowd out some of the noise at the margins.
Thank you, Andrew Seeley, for this conversation. I'm glad that the institution that you run is not just in America, happens to be located in the United States, but you really are trying to work on what is essentially a global problem at the global level.
Yes.
And that's the only way this can be successfully addressed. So good work.
Thanks for having me on today. Great to be with you, Alan.
Thank you for listening to this episode of New Thinking for a New World. I'm Alan Stoga, podcast host, and I look forward to your joining our next conversation. Remember, tell us what you think at telbergfoundation.org.